call the Commerce Committee to order. You've got four bills on the agenda. Let Senator Jensen go first with Senate File 2340, dealing with real estate brokers and salespersons, regulations and modifications. I think it's worked out, but we'll hear from Senator Jensen. Welcome to the committee, and with you is Mr. Ryan Hamilton from the Minnesota Association of Realtors. And unfortunately, Mr. Egger's mother passed away last evening, and the Eggers are good friends of my family and myself, and we've been, I think I was the first person to hire Mr. Egger at the at the Minnesota Capitol, so we wish he and his father and sister the best during these troubled times. And she was just, I don't know what his mother, I would guess she was only about 64 or something like that. Pretty darn young. But anyway, our condolences to Mr. Egger, who wanted to be here. But Ms. Senator Jensen, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I bring before you Senate File 2340. It deals with Chapter 82. The legislation was brought to me by the Minnesota Association of Realtors, and it makes mostly technical clarifying amendments to that chapter, the Real Estate Brokers and Salespersons chapter. It also makes a couple minor changes that Ryan will explain in just a little bit.
Did you want to, at this point, Senator Jensen has the A1 amendment that I believe has been worked out.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Everybody, I believe, has signed off on this. So Senator Jensen moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, let me say an aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion fails. So you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this time I'd like to introduce Ryan Hamilton, and he will walk through the provisions in the bill.
Welcome, Mr. Hamilton.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate File 2340 today, and thank you also for your kind remarks from my colleague. I'll be sure to relay those to him. My name is Ryan Hamilton, Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Association of Realtors. We'd like to thank Senator Jensen and our bipartisan group of co-authors for bringing this bill forward. I'd like to thank the Department of Commerce for their feedback and their willingness to work with us. We shared a draft of this bill early in September, and we were in communication with them throughout the fall and winter. They gave us several suggestions, which we were happy to incorporate in the bill that you see before you here today. I'm not aware of any opposition to this bill at this time. When the bill was first introduced, Mr. Elwood and folks from Legal Aid did have some questions about a few of our definitions that we had in there. And in an effort to keep the bill as non-controversial and technical as possible, we simply removed those provisions, and that's what's reflected in the amendment that we have today. The purpose of this bill is to do some much-needed cleanup to Chapter 82. So, yes, another unsessioned deal. Chapter 82 is a section of our statutes which governs real estate brokers and real estate salespersons. And what we did is over the summer and fall, we went through every section of the chapter line by line. We identified numerous, mostly technical, issues in the chapter that just required updating to be consistent with current real estate practice. Mr. Chair, instead of going through the bill section by section, I'll just summarize a few examples of what the bill does. I'll start with it deletes the obsolete language and adds definitions of terms that are used throughout the chapter but have never actually been defined in the chapter. Replaces terms that refer to filing paper copies with the Department of Commerce, replaces those with more general terms that would allow for electronic submissions or submissions that are prescribed in a manner by the commissioner. It strikes the sub-agency relationship from the chapter. Sub-agency is when a broker or a salesperson is working with the buyer but represents the seller. With the introduction way back when of buyer's representation and dual agency, sub-agency simply became obsolete. So it's not used anywhere in the state. We did a poll on that topic, and we're just going to take it out. Lastly, the bill updates the earnest money language. Current law dates to long before buyer representation and the situation that's most common today, which is that the buyer provides his or her representative with the earnest money. Since every purchase agreement already addresses the handling of earnest money, the bill makes whatever the parties agree to the default. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Okay. Any questions of Mr. Hamilton on this? Any questions on the bill? Anybody in the audience opposed to what Senator Jensen is doing here today? Okay, seeing none, I think a motion is in order. Senator Reinhart to move it for you, even though you, yeah. Okay. Senator Kosaka seconds it.
I do.
There's no second.
No. You're losing,
Senator.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Jensen's looking at me like, hey, I don't think we need that. On the motion, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And it's passed, and it's going to the Senate floor.
As amended. Thank you. Okay, now we have Senate File 2347. Senator Metzen.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Senate File 2347 is the Department of Commerce fix-up bill, we'll call it that, for the year. It basically does five things. Makes changes to the appraiser licensing to federally conform, updates Petrofund definitions, makes technical corrections in the Department of Commerce Administrative Services area, streamlines the department's enforcement powers, and adopts the NAIC Model Act. So with that, I'll let the Chair go through the bill.
Senator Metzen, would you like to
amendments? That's a good point. We have two amendments, the A3. That modifies the appraisal language and the trainee appraiser course stuff, and I think this has been worked out with the commissioner and everybody concerned about this area.
Does everyone have the A3 amendment?
Not quite yet.
I'd move the amendment.
Offer's amendment.
Senator Metzen moves the A3 amendment.
Keep on.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Is there another amendment?
Yeah, there's the A4 amendment. I'll let the commissioner give us about 10 words on this one. I think this is another one that has been worked out.
Okay, the A4 amendment.
On the A4,
Commissioner.
Yeah, thank you. Mike Rothman, the Commissioner of Commerce. This amendment modifies some of the language that we had for our summary order process. There's been discussions, and we think we've worked it out in principle to have this language. I think this morning is looked at, and some others are looking at it right now, but for now, this represents a positive direction, and we'll continue to work with folks on it.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, this has been, I think, 95% worked out with those interested, but we reserve kind of the right. We're going to, if there's work to be done, we'll look at that and maybe correct that later. But I think it's pretty well worked out. So.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions on the A4 amendment?
So moved.
Move the amendment. Senator Metzen moves the A4 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Metzen.
I'll send it over to the commissioner. He can go through the bill and see if there are any questions.
Commissioner Rothman, go ahead.
Thank you. I'll just start with Article 1. It contains federal appraiser licensing conformity. These changes are required by 2015 and are being adopted by all states. The amendments add a few items that came out of our regulatory organization that is in Washington, D.C., and it deals with individuals that need to teach and appraiser supervisory courses. The The Section 1 appraiser license has a federal conformity provision in it. Sections 2 and 3 relate to continuing education course completion certificate, which is technical in nature. Section 4 has appraiser license federal conformity, as well as Section 5 and a repealer in Section 6. The Article 2 relates to the Petra Fund. It makes a technical change in the Petra Fund area requested by the board, the Petra Fund board, and our staff. Specifically, Section 1 changes the definition of tank and tank in transport to clarify them so that we know what constitutes a mobile tank for purposes of our Petra Fund. And then, excuse me, Section 2 and 3 deal with the reimbursement deadline modification. Basically, changes it to a seven-year period, and we delay there's a grace one-year period to delay the implementation so everybody doesn't get caught with that seven-year limitation. Article 3 deals with administrative administrative services. It generally makes technical and purely technical corrections in our weights and measures area. I can go through those, but they're very meticulous and detailed, and not that necessary to go through. I'm happy to talk about them now. Article 4 in enforcement makes several changes to streamline and clarify the department's enforcement authority. Section 1 in the Chapter 45 authority, which is the main source of our authority, proposes a more efficient regulatory process than we have currently. In essence, in a nutshell, what we get is we do a lot of work, we do a lot of paperwork, we work with the Attorney General's office, and then we file a lot of orders against licensees. But often, many, many times, they default. They just give up. And what this does is it identifies a more efficient way. We'll save hundreds of thousands of dollars by this streamlined process. In fact, that's what the A4 amendment is modifying. It's some of the language we proposed here. And so the A4 amendment has the current version of the language that we're going with for now. Section 2, I think that's been, I don't know if that's still in or not. Section 4, in fact, I think that's taken out in the delete all amendment. In Section 4, we change when insurance producers are required to report criminal prosecution so that we get earlier warning of those that are in criminal trouble. We make, in Section 3, some title insurance changes. They're straightforward technical updates, basically calling the entities the language that we typically refer to them. Title insurance companies referred to as a title insurer, etc. In Article 5, we have two model holding company acts in Article 5 is a holding company act, and Article 6 is a second model act. The first one in Article 5 is an important update to Minnesota's insurance regulations. We've had a holding company regulation on the books for decades. It modifies it, and in essence, a holding company is defined as is consisting of two or more affiliated entities. The first NAIC model was done in 1969. These current changes were adopted in 2010, in large part in response to the downturn, the Great Recession, and some of the problems that we saw there. For accreditation purposes, our department needs to have these on deck and in place by January 1, 2016. So far, 26 states have already adopted it, and it's important to our domestic insurers to adopt this because there will be pressure to file this with other state regulators, and if we have it in our state, they won't have to. It'll streamline the process so that we can do the regulation here in our state. The next one, Article 6, again, is in response to some of the problems that happened in the Great Recession. And what this does is adopts what's called an own risk and solvency assessment tool to allow insurance regulators to be able to set up a framework to monitor and assess the prospectively the risks of an insurance company, their capital adequacy and solvency assessment. Think of it this way. The way that we currently regulate involves looking at a bunch of data, a lot of data that comes into the department. It's current data, but what we don't see and what we don't regulate is prospectively in terms of what insurance companies see going forward. So we often think of this as regulating not through the rear view mirror, but looking forward in the direction and giving insurance regulators the ability to see what insurance companies are seeing in terms of the risks that they have in the competition, the marketplace, and in their capital requirements. And so these two model acts together are meant to bring basically Minnesota into the 21st century with respect to some very important things. So with respect to the Model Holding Company Act, we're going to adopt supervisory colleges. We'll have enterprise risk reporting, and with the ORSA assessment, we'll be able to, for the large insurance companies that we have here in Minnesota, be able to see a little bit more prospectively about the risks that that they're facing. Those are the major provisions of the bill, and with that, I turn it back to Senator Metzen.
Senator Metzen?
I believe this is cleanup language, and I think pretty much in agreement with all the stakeholders. So unless there's some questions, the commissioner's here. And
Senator Gazelka?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, just some comments, because I support the bill as it is. We kind of went through this last year where we had some of the bigger agency bills came, and they came at the last minute, I think, to the industry and to us. And I will say the improvement from last year to this year is Peter Brickwitty came to my office and reviewed it last week, and I appreciate that. And so I don't know where the breakdown is. I've got this Appendix C from Governor Dayton's office where he signs off on the direction we want to go, and it's dated February 24th. But somewhere, so whether it's you or whether it's the governor or in that process, we want some more time on some of these bigger bills so that we're not kind of rushing at the last second. So I'm not necessarily placing blame on you. It may be on the governor, but somewhere in here we need more time on some of these bigger ones. Then we won't have these where we've got last-minute volatility that we didn't need. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Commissioner, do you want to respond?
I'm happy to. I mean, I'm completely happy to continue to work on improving that.
Any other questions? I guess, Commissioner Rothman, I do have a question on the Amendment A4. The Section 2.7 that deals with the cost of the investigation, is that a new authority, or are you just changing the... I guess I need some clarity on what that section is.
Madam Chair, no, that's not new authority. It's existing authority. We already do those costs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Is there someone that wants to come and speak to this bill? Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I am representing America's Health Insurance Plans. America's Health Insurance Plans is the nationwide trade association representing the health insurance industry. AHIP members provide health insurance supplemental benefits to more than 200 million Americans through employer-sponsored coverage, the individual insurance market, and public programs such as Medicare and Medicaid. AHIP advocates for public policies that expand the access to affordable health care coverage to all Minnesotans through a competitive marketplace that fosters choice, quality, innovation, and our members include many of Minnesota's health plans, insurers, and my other client, Preferred One. I'm here today to speak in favor of Articles 5 and 6, the Holding Company Acts, and the Owned Risk and Solvency Assessment Model Acts. You heard the commissioner say these are very important for the local plans. They're also very important for the national plans so that we can continue to do business across state lines. We support these provisions as model acts drafted by the NAIC, and we're working with the department to make sure that all the I's are dotted and all the T's are crossed here in the next couple of days. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd strongly urge your support. If there are any questions, be happy to answer them.
Thank you for your comments. Yeah. Senator Metzen?
Yeah, I think we're ready for a motion. And I'll make the motion to move this bill. I believe it can go to the floor as amended.
Senator Metzen recommends that we approve Senate file. 2347, and recommended to pass and move to the floor as amended. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you very much.
Next on the agenda is Senate File 2624. Is Senator Kent? There she is. Welcome, Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bear with me 1 second.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am here today to present Senate File 2624. Just as quick background, the Department of Public Safety has long sold automobile accident report information to insurance companies, newspapers, and other organizations that use this data for a wide range of business purposes. This subject has received a lot of attention recently. It is a part of a bigger question. This bill is not that bigger question. This bill is a much more focused look at the revenue that it comes through those kind of report fees. So this bill requires that the revenue generated from the sale of accident reports would go into the insurance fraud prevention account. Under current law, 90% of the revenue goes into the driver services operating fund and 10% into the general fund. Let's see. And so as you go through the bill, it's pretty straightforward in 1.12 through 1.14. That's where it specifies that it goes into that account. And then on 3, 6, and 7, it just puts it all into that one account as opposed to the 90-10 split that used to be in there. It's pretty straightforward. It is, as I said, a narrow version of a much bigger question that's being discussed in other legislation. So with that, I would like to introduce Bob Johnson from the Insurance Federation of Minnesota to talk about this aspect of it.
Mr. Johnson, go ahead.
Madam Chair and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Senator Kent, I think, has done a good job of just putting this bill in the context of what is a bigger issue in the 2014 session regarding these access to bulk records at the Department of Public Safety and the charges for what has been, for a number of years, sold on a bulk basis, moving to a $5 per record charge. Like Senator Kent has another bill that actually deals with the broader issue. I guess I'm here today to the extent that I'm not sure where this issue ends up, because it's a very live wire in both the House and the Senate, this issue of records at the Department of Public Safety. But I believe we're looking at a scenario in the weeks and months ahead that there could be some considerable new revenue coming into the agency above and beyond what's currently there if the sales of these motor vehicle registration information and driver vehicle information moves to a $5 charge per record. Then a lot of revenue, and I don't know the number, but I believe it would be a lot of revenue. The key thing is it will be new revenue beyond whatever is in place today. And as Senator Kent described, that there is a split between the dollars collected today between the agency and general revenue. So I'm here today because I fully support, I think, efforts, even from the hearing last week, Madam Chair, and the bill that you are authoring, support at this committee to do everything we can to get dollars into the insurance fraud prevention account. You've heard Ramsey County Attorney John Choi address that, and you'll hear other prosecutors and other law enforcement. So there's a need there, and I guess I look at this bill and the issue raised here as perhaps a golden opportunity for moving some new revenue, and that may well start again in the weeks ahead into a very worthy area, I think, for the state public policy and where these dollars could help an important cause. So that's be my testimony, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Does anyone have any questions? Is there anyone that wants to speak to this bill?
Chairman, Senator Metzen would like me to move 2624.
Okay, Senator Pratt. Where's it moves. Recommends Senate File 2624, recommended to pass and move to Transportation and Public Safety. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Next on the agenda is Senate File 2215. Is Senator Franzen? Should I call Senator Pratt?
Yeah.
There she is. Senator Franzen, welcome to the Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I have introduced Senate File 2215 to amend our state's biodiesel law to try to address some of the problems that our constituents are likely to experience beginning this summer, unless the legislature acts this session. Here's a brief history of the issue as I understand it today. In 2002, the legislature passed a 2% biodiesel content requirement. In 2008, that mandate was increased to 5%. And the legislature granted authority to three commissioners to impose a 10% biodiesel mandate if certain conditions were met. In September 2013, the commissioners issued a letter stating that conditions were met and indicating that the 10% mandate would begin this July 1st, 2014. This mandate means that it will be illegal for anyone to sell diesel fuel with less than 10% biodiesel content. Here's the problem created by this decision. Most of the 125,000 diesel vehicles now on the road in Minnesota are not made to run on biodiesel levels greater than 5%. Included in your packet is a letter from General Motors indicating their consent for their 37,000 older vehicles on the road in Minnesota that may start experiencing problems using fuel not recommended for their vehicles. Additionally, all new passenger diesel vehicles sold in Minnesota, except one, are also made to run on biodiesel levels not greater than 5%. So Minnesota law, unless we act this session, will make it illegal for anyone to sell that fuel that is recommended for optimal performance for most of the diesel vehicles on the road still being sold in our state. I want to make it clear that I am very supportive of alternative fuels in general and of the Minnesota biodiesel industry in particular. I happen to own a diesel vehicle myself. But a lot has changed in the last 6 years with regards to both the state's biodiesel industry and the automobile market. And we need to have a broad discussion about what Minnesota's biodiesel mandate, what it means to have this mandate become law. Not only to the biodiesel industry and our state's agriculture economy, but to our state's automotive industry and their customers, whose interests were not taken into consideration in the 2008 law. Minnesota's biodiesel mandate did jumpstart an industry that has benefited the state. Minnesota was a leader. In 2002, when the original 2% mandate passed, there were only 15 million gallons of biodiesel produced in America. In 2008, this number had grown to 700 million gallons. And this past year, there were 1.8 billion gallons of biodiesel in production, 2.5 times as much as 2008. Without Minnesota having a 10% biodiesel mandate in effect. But one of the most significant changes since 2008 is an ever-increasing introduction of more and more new diesel vehicles. When the federal government enacted stricter fuel economy standards in 2009, automobile manufacturers looked to clean-burning diesel, which gets 20 to 40% better mileage to the gallon than gasoline, to help reduce fuel consumption and the corresponding emissions. In 2008, there were 5 models of passenger cars and 11 total diesel vehicles fueled by diesel available in the U.S. In 2014, there are now 28 diesel models for sale. That number is expected to grow to 40 to 45 vehicles models by next year, and diesel vehicles are anticipated to be 10% of the total vehicle market in the next 4 years. This rapidly expanding diesel fleet provides a great opportunity to sell more biodiesel, but not if there's a law impeding the sale of these diesel vehicles. And that is the problem. Most of these 28 models now being sold in Minnesota are designed to run on no more than 10% biodiesel content. as are the 125,000 vehicles already on the road. And that fuel will no longer be available in Minnesota's marketplace starting this July. Most importantly, the impending state mandate is having a chilling effect on car sales. What happens if those vehicles encounter mechanical failures due to the 10% biodiesel? Who is left to deal with this issue? These are important considerations that the 2008 law is silent on. I am bringing this bill forward because I believe this biodiesel mandate may be premature. We as policymakers have a responsibility to Minnesota consumers, our constituents, to ensure that the proper fuel they need to get to work and go about their day is not illegal to sell in this state. I should mention that Minnesota's 10% biodiesel mandate will be the only one in the country. No other state requires more than a B5 content. As members of the Committee on Commerce, it's also in your purview to ensure that this 2008 law does not adversely affect retail operations and other aspects of commerce in our state. With me today, I have representatives from a number of suppliers and consumers of diesel fuel who are worried that our Minnesota mandate has gotten ahead of the marketplace, and they are worried about the fallout if we do not reexamine the law. I can go into what the bill does, but I want to also acknowledge Senator Pratt, who is also author in a clone bill that supports this legislation moving forward.
Senator Franson, did you have an amendment that you would like to
take? I do. The committee would like to move that, or Senator Pratt?
I'd like to move the author's amendment.
Senator Pratt
moves the A1?
The A1 amendment.
It's A.
Oh,
it's a revised 14. One.
A14.
A14.
0828. Thank you.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'll move that one.
Okay. Senator Pratt. Moves the amendment. Does anyone have? It's an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm pleased to join Senator Franson in this effort that has equal bipartisan support between the two bills. There's no doubt that agriculture is an important industry in Minnesota. In fact, it accounts for 20% of our GDP in the state, according to a January 2013 U of M report. Ethanol and biodiesel have provided another outlet for our crops and has helped support higher prices for both soybeans and corn. This issue is before the committee because these new mandates have a direct effect on consumers. The sale of diesel cars and trucks have been on the rise due to their reliability, fuel efficiency, and availability. As you will see and hear today, the state is prematurely raising the minimum fuel mandates, and we could see a decline in new and used vehicles that create potential impacts to customers and that have not only those who will purchase, but those who have purchased and could see their warranties invalidated. So, I too support renewable fuels. In fact, I have a flex fuel vehicle that I occasionally run on E85. It's nice to have that choice. The goal here is not to invalidate the current B5 mandate, as the amendment will state, but rather to push out the mandate for a while, and it would be my long-term goal to have higher biodiesel availability follow the E85 model where the marketplace catches up to the availability of fuel. With that, I'll let the testifiers go, but thank you, Madam Chair and committee.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Franzen.
Just to give a brief on what this amendment does, Section 1, it delays an increase in B10 until 2020, so most of the current legacy vehicles are retired and new vehicles can meet the standard. It eliminates the B20 mandate, so we don't have the same consumer issues again in a few years. It adds a condition that the fuels must work in all vehicle models on the road, similar to the state's 20% ethanol statute. It requires a contested case hearing before the commissioners approve of the B10 increase. The current process provides no public input, only that commissioners consider the input on the biodiesel task force, which doesn't represent consumer interests. Shortens the months B10 would be in effect from April through October to May through September. Biodiesel gels at warmer temperatures, causing problems with storage and handling in colder months. It strengthens the pricing of off-ramp by defining the price disparity between diesel and biodiesel that would trigger suspension of the mandate. The current law only requires periodic review of any price differentials and asks officials to consider suspension of the mandate if it costs an economic hardship to retailers. The Department of Ag and Commerce have been saying that since 2011, they have no way to define economic hardship. Our language defines it as a more than 10 cent per gallon difference. And Section 2 eliminates the sunset for exempt industries, nuclear mining, railroads, forestry, and logging. And I just want to mention for the record, we've been in communication with the Department of Ag and Commerce and trying to find a solution for this, the concerns that we have for consumers, and we're going to continue to have that discussion. I think this testimony and this hearing is furthering that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Frenzen, on line 2.13, what is the impact of the last 4 years, regardless of model year? I'm just curious of how that impacts the legislation.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Senator Gazelka, the regardless of model year, that language came from the statute that we use. Are you looking at 2.13?
Yeah, I'm sorry, 2.13 of the amendment. I'm just wondering what impact it has on the percentage of biofuel, like B5, B10. I mean, if you've got any model year, you know, if there's a 1980 out on the road, what's the impact of that?
Madam Chair, Senator Gazelka, it's assuring that consumers who have purchased a car and have a legacy vehicle are able to continue to use their vehicle, so this would protect consumers.
Okay. Senator Ladd.
Sorry. Just to follow up on that, correct me if I'm wrong, but the way I read it, as Senator Gazelka suggested, if one consumer has a currently registered 1980 model diesel-powered vehicle in Minnesota, then the Commissioner of Public Safety would be prohibited from issuing the certification.
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, and that's correct. That's how it currently is written. I'm certainly open to suggestions, but the fact that we would be the only state in the country with a 10% mandate, and we have borders, people are coming from other states coming to Minnesota, we want to make sure that they're also able to find the fuel they need when they come through our state borders.
Well, Madam Chair, I can already picture one Minnesota resident who is belonging to the consortium that's advocating for this bill just deciding they're going to maintain their car in Minnesota registered no matter how old forever, and thereby by statute prohibiting any new mandate ever from coming into effect. So at least that particular part of the bill, it turns over the entire decision-making process to the manufacturers. It divests the Commissioner of Public Safety from, frankly, any authority whatsoever in this, as long as they don't change their standards and there's one car running. That's the end of it.
Okay, committee, I just would like to say that we want to start the testimony part of this presentation, and the way that we're going to handle it is that each side gets 40 minutes. So plan accordingly and prepare your statements so that at 40 minutes we will move to we'll start with the proponents and Amber Bacchus and from the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association and go for 40 minutes with that group, and then we will go to the opponents and start with that group.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Amber Bacchus, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. And we do appreciate you taking the time to hear Senate Files 2215 and Senate File 2351. These bills bring parity to the state's biodiesel statute by delaying the 10% biodiesel mandate until it's compatible with all vehicles on the road by adding a consumer-focused aspect to the law, similar to what's included in Minnesota's E20 statute. And to Senator Latz's point, the language about irrespective of model year is from Minnesota's E20 statute. In terms of who should determine when you meet that, I guess we're open to discussion, but we're using that as a starting point moving forward. In 2008, when the bill authorizing the higher content levels was passed, the primary diesel users at the table were trucking companies, not passenger fleets. And as a result, the four conditions that trigger an increase in the content level had to do with the fuel standards, soybean production, and refining capacity. Consumer impacts were not contemplated. Because of this, we have 23 dealers from Albert Lea to Duluth who are now caught in the crosshairs of the policy to increase the state's biodiesel mandate to B10 on July 1st. They have the opportunity to sell new clean diesel cars that will significantly increase the amount of biodiesel consumed in the state, but the state's proposed move to B10 is having the opposite effect. Under the state's consumer protection laws, our dealers have a responsibility to inform their customers that the fuel needed to operate their vehicles will not be available come July. But it's more complicated than that. There is uncertainty about how using biodiesel blends at higher levels than recommended will impact these vehicles and whether the use will cause related mechanical issues, which a subsequent testifier will speak to. Our dealers also don't know whether the warranties will be honored if use of B10 is the reason a vehicle malfunctions. We have recommended that our dealers provide a disclosure to their customers that relates each of these points, a copy of which is found in your packets. And when presented with this disclosure, customers who are considering investing between $23,000 and $65,000 in a clean diesel car either resort to purchasing the lower-cost gasoline version with worse fuel economy or walk away altogether. This is counterproductive. Additionally, we have heard repeatedly from proponents of the 10% mandate about foreign manufacturers who are not making cars to meet the law. But it's not the foreign manufacturers who are hurt by this policy. It's Minnesota's businesses who are paying the price. Together, these 23 dealerships employ nearly 2,500 Minnesotans with combined payrolls in excess of $102 million. They are losing sales and corresponding commissions of a hot and greener new market because of the uncertainty surrounding Minnesota's mandate. Essentially, the current state policy is guaranteeing a market for biodiesel at the expense of Minnesota's new car market, which represents 12.1% of total retail sales in the state and generates almost $650 million in sales tax revenue. We believe that the state has a role in ensuring that Minnesota citizens have access to the fuel needed to operate their vehicles. We simply ask you to support delaying the increase to 10% so this fundamental tenet can be met and our customers and your constituents can be confident that their cars will have the fuel required to run reliably. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I think what we'll do is if members of the committee can hold their questions, we'll allow the testimony to take place and then have questions later. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the Commerce Committee, my name is Sandy Naren. I'm with Messerly & Kramer, and I'm here today on behalf of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. I am pinch-hitting for Renee Wadsworth, who I think you have on your list. Renee was supposed to fly in this morning from Washington to testify, and as some of you may have heard, they had 9 inches of snow there this morning and pretty well has shut down the entire city and the federal government. So I am pinch-hitting for her today.
Welcome.
The Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers is a trade association of 12 of the biggest car manufacturers in the world. The members are BMW, Chrysler, Ford, General Motors, Jaguar Land Rover, Mazda, Mercedes, Mitsubishi, Porsche, Toyota, Volkswagen, and Volvo. And as you have seen in many of your handouts, we've had concerns about this mandate for a number of reasons. I have represented this trade association since it was formed in 1999, and I did work for the manufacturing industry before this group was even formed. So I have been representing them since 1985, off and on a number of issues. We did not oppose the B2 mandate when it was passed by this legislature. We did not oppose the B5 mandate when it was passed by this legislature. But the manufacturers did have concerns when they saw an impending B10 mandate. Over 18 months ago, representatives from 5 different car manufacturers came to Minnesota and spent the day having meetings with the Commissioner of Ag and also with key officials from the Commerce Department to express the concerns that they had about the impending mandate and the effect on the motor vehicle fleet in Minnesota. We have 125,000 diesel vehicles on the road in Minnesota now. Most of those diesel vehicles belong to Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler. They're pickup trucks, vans, and SUVs. Those same 3 manufacturers do recommend use of B10 for their newer vehicles in model years 2012 and newer, but they voiced concerns, and General Motors was at this meeting in 18 months ago, they voiced concerns about the impact on their vehicles that were already on the road in Minnesota. And many of these vehicles are already outside of warranty. This is not just a warranty issue. This is customers being unhappy and having problems with their vehicles for whatever reason. So those manufacturers all did come into town. In addition to the 125,000 that are already on the road, we have about five car manufacturers who are now making about a dozen different passenger vehicles. Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler vehicles are mainly pickup trucks and vans. There are five manufacturers also making passenger vehicles. Only one of those 12 vehicles is recommended for use of anything more than B5, just one. So the situation we are presented with now in Minnesota with a 10% mandate is that most of the vehicles on the road and most of the new vehicles being sold are not recommended for use for anything more than B5. So we agree with Senator Franzen that we think this mandate is a little premature. We are hopeful that we can continue talks with those who are advocating on the other side. As some of you saw, I was sitting next to one of those lobbyists and consider him a very good friend. And we'd like to continue to have those talks, and we hope you as legislators will encourage that to take place. So our biggest concern is for our customers and for all those vehicles on the road. 10% biodiesel can already be sold in Minnesota, and we encourage those to sell it where it is appropriate. There are vehicles that can take it, but most vehicles cannot. Glad to stand for any other questions.
Thank you. Next on the list is Kevin Thoma. And if a couple want to come up at a time, the next one would be Bill. Ooh. Wapkenberg. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for hearing me this morning. I appreciate your time. My name is Kevin Thoma. I work for the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. We are the licensed wholesale distributors of petroleum in Minnesota. The mandate that you see before you today in Statute 239.77 falls directly upon us. The language in the bill, as you can see, clearly states that all diesel fuels sold or offered for sale in Minnesota. It doesn't include use. It just covers for sale or offered for sale in Minnesota. That's why the mandate falls strictly on my members. When the federal biodiesel blender's credit of a dollar was not renewed in December, the economics of biodiesel fuel changed. Biodiesel fuel became more expensive to buy than previously and compared to clear fuel. The current rate difference is about 2.5 cents. So if we're selling B5 in Minnesota, we're 2.5 cents more expensive than non-mandated states. It stands to reason that in July, when the B10 mandate goes into effect, we'll essentially be about 5 cents higher than the other states that don't have mandates. Under the UCC, folks can buy fuel in North Dakota. If that sale takes place in North Dakota, they can have it delivered to Minnesota, and those folks would be in compliance because the sale happened in North Dakota, Iowa, South Dakota, any of our neighboring states. Another issue that we are concerned with is the performance of B10 in the cold months. I passed out a picture. This photo is of a filter that was taken from a fuel dispensary location. It is one of the filters from the Minnesota Transit folks, the buses that run here in the metro. This filter was taken off of that pump in July. So you can see what happened to the biodiesel in July. Our concerns are going to be what will happen in April and May, what will happen in September and October. You can treat biodiesel, and that's what our members have been doing to make biodiesel work here in Minnesota, especially during the, when it's 22 below zero. We're adding number one to the biodiesel to to lower the cold point and the cold filter plug points, but that comes at an expense to consumers. With that, I will stand for questions.
Okay, very good. The next testifier, I screwed up a few names a couple weeks ago. And, why don't you tell us?
I'm used to it. Name? Yeah. My name is Bill Webkenberg.
Oh, that's not so. Okay, I got to figure that one out.
That's right. That's right.
Welcome.
It's high score in Scrabble. So.
Okay. welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify before this committee. My name is Bill Webkenberg, and I'm responsible for fuels, technical, and regulatory affairs in the United States for Mercedes-Benz Research and Development, North America. And I'm here today to testify on behalf of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers regarding the technical issues associated with the use of biodiesel blends greater than those recommended by manufacturers. In my almost 30 years in the auto industry, I worked the majority of the time at Ford Motor Company on powertrain and vehicle development, as well as dealing with critical customer issues at the dealership level. Therefore, customer satisfaction has been ingrained in my thinking. Starting in 2010, examples of low power installing due to the effects of B11 usage were reported in Illinois by various OEMs. Those symptoms, driven by plug fuel filters, sticky EGR, or exhaust gas recirculation emission valves, carbon intake manifolds, and related causes, all increased in frequency of occurrence after the 6.25% fuel tax rebate was enacted for sales of biodiesel blends greater than B10. Typically, plug fuel filters are associated with cold temperatures and waxing of fuel, but in these cases, the plug fuel filters occurred well above the cloud point of the fuel, where wax crystals start to form in the fuel. This can occur because of poor fuel quality, but also from good quality fuel, which has degraded over time. As the blend level increases, the likelihood and frequency of events also increases. What is most concerning about plug filters, aside from customer inconvenience of needing a vehicle tow and repair, is that low power installing can result from fuel filter plugging. Sticky EGR valves can also result in low power installing, which again poses some concern for the customer. But other more expensive failures occurred as well. At least one manufacturer reported low mileage engine failures by well-maintained vehicles which suffered oil starvation due to extreme oil sludging brought about by biodiesel dilution of engine oil. Oil dilution occurs when fuel is injected into the cylinder after normal combustion occurs with the intent to burn off soot deposits in the exhaust particulate filter. Some unburned fuel inevitably washes into the oil pan and ultimately evaporates out of the oil. However, since biodiesel has a very, very high boiling point, it will never evaporate from the oil. It remains there and then rapidly degrades into undesirable byproducts like acids and ultimately sludge, which over time can damage an engine. The Alliance is concerned that similar offense may unfold in Minnesota as a direct result of the impending B10 mandate slated to commence July 1 of this year. This B10 mandate could have even more deleterious consequences than those experienced in Illinois, because the availability of B5 would not merely be reduced but outlawed, thus increasing the likelihood of issues related to B10 usage. And it is important to stress that these concerns are not just an Alliance issue for new vehicles. They apply to the legacy diesel fleet registered in Minnesota, diesel passenger cars, light diesel trucks, and van small manufacturers, the vast majority of which recommend B5 usage only. SF-2215 and 2351 strive to protect the customer against the B10 mandate, which requires the customer to use a fuel not recommended by the manufacturer and outlaws the use of the prescribed B5 fuel. These bills also seek to protect them and their investments from the likely repairs associated with chronic B10 usage. The Alliance fully supports a national B5 standard, which provides uniformity of fuel quality across the United States. We also support introduction of renewable fuels in such a manner which encourages its use without penalizing the customers in the process. Thank you for the opportunity to present this testimony in support of SF-2215 and 2351 so that the appropriate fuel for diesel consumers will continue to be available. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Kyle Kotke Trucking, and John Husladen. Welcome to the Minnesota Senate. You may proceed to whatever you'd like to go first. Yeah.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Houselot, and I'm president of the Minnesota Trucking Association. And we're a statewide organization representing over 680 carriers and their allied vendors. And I'm here today to speak in support of Senate File 2215. I do have one of my members here today with me, Mr. Kyle Cotty, so I'll just make a few brief introductory remarks and then let him talk about his experience. The Minnesota Trucking Association is no stranger to biodiesel legislation. We actively opposed the original mandate when it was proposed in 2002, and then we did not oppose increasing the mandated level when the statute was amended in 2008. Now, you may ask, well, why the change in position? Because in that process in 2008, when we were negotiating the bill, there was an economic hardship provision added which we believed would do just that. It would protect our members against unreasonably higher costs due to the mandate. However, from our experience, that provision is simply not working. It focuses exclusively on those who sell the fuel, not those who burn it. And furthermore, the Department of Commerce has publicly admitted that it has no practical way to track and measure such price disparities. We believe that the 10-cent differential in Senate File 2215 gives all involved parties a tangible target, and it should motivate the agency to refine its measurement processes. One thing I do know for sure, my members can and they do track price disparities. And every day, they make decisions to mitigate biodiesel cost impacts. And here to tell you about their practices is Mr. Kyle Kotke, who is Vice Chair of the Minnesota Trucking Association.
Mr. Kotke, welcome to the Minnesota Senate.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Kyle Kotke, a trucker from Buffalo Lake. Together with my brothers, we operate a 75-truck fleet and haul refrigerated foods to 28 states. I am also the vice chairman of the Minnesota Trucking Association, and I'm here to speak in support of SF 2215. I'm a proud Minnesotan who loves to support his state and his hometown. So it pains me greatly to tell you that I purchase fuel for my trucks outside of Minnesota at any opportunity I can. The reason is biodiesel. To put simply, I cannot afford the 3 to 5 cents per gallon that B5 mandate adds to my cost of fuel. We purchase 2 million gallons of diesel fuel per year, so even buying a portion of that fuel adds up fast. We buy fuel in Hudson, Wisconsin, Mason City, Iowa, and other towns like these so that we can avoid the cost and remain competitive with other trucking companies going after the same freight that we haul. Increasing the mandate to 10% is only going to increase those costs, drive other truckers like me to avoid buying Minnesota fuel. Kotke Trucking is not alone. In a recent survey of our members, nearly 60% of our respondents reported that they or their drivers avoid buying fuel in Minnesota because of biodiesel. And when our trucking company does buy fuel in Minnesota, we implement a number of other costly measures to ensure reliable performance. With customers expecting 98% on-time delivery, we simply cannot afford a truck to go down. So to speak, we spend money on additional insurance. In that same survey, a majority of our members reported that number one diesel was added to their blend, which costs more per gallon and gets fewer miles per gallon. Incorporating synthetic additives, replacing filters more frequently, and adding multiple heating devices, all of these cost more and are not included in any fuel pricing report. Granted, it has been a cold winter, and fuel has challenges with or without biodiesel. But when we drill down and ask our members, does biodiesel make your winter operation problems worse, we get a consistent yes. I'm here today to urge you to support SF 2215 to prevent Minnesota's biodiesel mandate from going to 10% this year. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Brian Sweeney from the BNSF Railway. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brian Sweeney with BNSF Railway in St. Paul, also speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Regional Railroad Association. BNSF Railway is a major user of diesel fuel. System-wide, we burn about 1.4 billion gallons of diesel fuel per year, so we're always interested in alternative fuels. We've done a lot of experimentation with hydrogen, with looking at liquid natural gas right now, and yes, we are interested in biodiesel. But we believe that it is necessary to extend the exemption or remove the sunset from it for a number of reasons. When the legislation was first passed, the rail industry was exempted because the manufacturers said flat out that using biodiesel would void the warranties on the locomotives. Since then, General Electric has said that they will allow a blend of 5%, up to 5%, but no more than that. Even the 5% is somewhat qualified. It applies only to the newer versions of locomotives, not the older ones that are still in use and comprise about 75% of the nation's locomotive fleet. Number two, they noted when they took the position of 5% being permissible in those locomotives that even so, using 2% diesel fuel is optimal, that if you use something other than 2% diesel fuel, you could run into problems with performance, reliability, maintenance, and regulatory compliance. Diesel locomotives cost about, a new one costs about $2 million apiece. It has a warranty that runs for several years, and so we are very concerned about this imposition of a higher mandate. Also, the short lines, which use primarily older locomotives, would have to retrofit in order to be able to use biodiesel. Estimates are coming in at about $150,000 per locomotive to do the retrofitting. Our major fueling location in Minneapolis receives fuel by pipeline. Pipelines that ship jet aviation fuel will not ship biodiesel fuel as well because of concerns about cross-contamination. The pipeline company that serves our facility has told us they will not and do not plan to ship biodiesel in that pipeline. We would have to convert to taking delivery by truck. That would mean about 8 or 10 truckloads a day on the Twin Cities highway system and an additional cost to us of about $500,000 a year for getting our fuel delivered. The tests that we've done with biodiesel today have been mixed. In general, yes, it will burn in a locomotive. However, we have experienced problems related to filter plugging, and also we have found that when locomotives are placed in storage, which happens on a regular basis, when they're placed in storage for any length of time, we wind up with corrosion and pitting problems with the injectors when biodiesel fuel is used. Another problem that we have is the rail industry is under a mandate from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to reduce its NOx emissions, a component of smog. While we have that mandate on upon us, we know that biodiesel increases NOx emissions with diesel locomotives. So we have a state mandate to use a fuel that creates more NOx at the same time that the U.S. EPA is telling us to reduce NOx emissions. Also, biodiesel blends as high as the ones in Minnesota in the current statute have not been tested in the newer generations of locomotives that are coming online to help meet the EPA requirements. And then finally, the Federal Railroad Administration is under a mandate right now. It is in the process of testing biodiesel in freight service. And I think it would be premature to impose the use of biodiesel on the rail industry at a time when so many problems are out there and the issue is still being studied at the federal level. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Pagel, Iron Mining Association. Greg, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair, Senators. My name is Craig Pagel. I'm the president of the Iron Mining Association of Minnesota. We represent 8 active mines right now, iron mines in northern Minnesota, and about 185 members of different companies that supply products and services to the industry. I'm here today for two things. One, those people that supply products and services to the mines, often large construction companies or even smaller, do use diesel on a daily basis. In northern Minnesota, they have found that they've had some problems with this and therefore support the bill as well, the problems they've had with B5. And I think where part of that problem is coming from is the mixing alone. Northern Minnesota does not have a facility that does a hot mix. It's all a cold splash blend. which has been causing some problems because it does separate readily. These problems are compounded in the wintertime when we can have temperatures somewhere between 20 and 40 below that they operate in on a daily basis. I'm also here as far as the mines themselves and the exemption that they have for biodiesel. We would like the sunset to be removed. Quite frankly, as was noted before, we're under orders from the EPA. When you start looking at Tier 4 air emissions, we do not know quite what those emission levels will be. We will have to redo our air permits with the state of Minnesota. The problem is some of the vehicles that we've bought, and these vehicles are not small. They're 240-ton haul trucks. When fully loaded, weigh 1,000 tons. We have received loads of B5 by accident, even though we have the exemption, and would have been from one of these cold-blooded systems. It stopped one mine's every one of their vehicles. Now imagine being on the road here in Minnesota in one of the freeways if you have your vehicle stop. But now take a 1,000-ton vehicle, fully loaded, probably on an incline, because that's when they have to operate at their hardest, and it stopped. You somehow have to get that truck restarted back in where they can do repairs. And the repairs on these very large production trucks are expensive. I've been told up to $400,000 for a complete retrofit. So that's why we ask that the exemption not only be not just be extended, but if you can see to remove the sunset completely. As we move forward and more is known about what Tier 4 requirements that we'll have for the vehicles, they will take a look at that. We do have some vehicles that are noted that can run on B5. However, warranties very boldly state you're responsible for approving it wasn't the fuel. So it really negates that saying that can run on B5, especially with the extreme cold temperatures we have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cagle. Wayne Brandt, Minnesota Forest Industries.
Minnesota timber producers today, Mr. Chairman.
Our members are loggers.
Wayne Brandt, Executive Vice President, Minnesota Timber Producers. Members are loggers, truckers, small sawmills, allied businesses. And thank you for the opportunity to be here. I do have a letter that kind of outlines where we're at. If we could have that passed out, a letter that we sent to the governor recently. To be clear, we are not opposed to the, have not opposed the biodiesel mandate. We have had a number of significant fuel problems, which I will just briefly cover, particularly over the past 5 months. And I realize some of this is outside of the scope of the legislation in front of you, but I'll keep you to the 40-minute deadline. First of all, we experienced some spot shortages of number one diesel. That was most significant in the far western and northwestern part of the state. And I'll try not to speculate on what the causes of these problems are, because one of the things we asked the governor is to, and his agencies, to work with us on determining causes and solutions. Secondly, we have seen this winter ongoing instances of filter clogging in the on-road trucks. We, too, have an exemption for the off-road logging equipment, but our on-road trucks burn diesel all year, or burn biodiesel all year round. You know, after some initial problems when the mandate was first enacted, we had not experienced many of those problems. They have recurred, and we're not exactly sure why. While the off-road equipment is exempt, we have had some similar problems in the off-road logging equipment that is exempt from the biodiesel mandate. So we've experienced in that non-biodiesel fueled equipment repeated filter clogging and other problems. We had what we and our fuel suppliers believe to be a bad batch, point number four, earlier this winter, which seems to happen occasionally. Finally, point number five. In the past, we've been able to buy P-40 out of Canada. For whatever reason, that has not been available to us this winter, and it has been an extremely cold winter. You know, our members have been spending hundreds of dollars a day in fuel additives and filters. That adds up over the course of the logging season. These problems have occurred in cold conditions, normal conditions, and what we would consider to be warmer weather conditions. You know, our expectation is pretty simple for the fuel that we purchase, and that is that the fuel that we purchase works in the equipment that we purchase to have it run, and that it works in the conditions in which we operate. So we look forward to working with you, other legislators, the administration, to resolve these problems. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I want to thank the proponents for being right on schedule here. We've got actually 10 more minutes to go for the proponents. I think we'll take some questions from a member. Senator Kosoka?
Well, I have a few. You know, some of the groups that testified, the railroad locomotives, the logging, are they not excluded from the mandates right now anyway? Or why not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kosoka, the proposal will have the elimination of the sunset. So they are going to get, we're asking for a permanent exemption.
Thank you.
Okay,
go
ahead.
Mr. Chair and Senators, there's also another handout that has some photographs or pictures of some of the clogging that we're talking about in testimony, so you have a picture in your head of what the filters look like. So that should be in your packets as well. And lastly, I would say, considering I made my, I guess my freshman goal was to get bipartisan support on legislation with certain senators. I think I accomplished that by having Senator Bach and Senator Hand both being my co-authors of this bill and both being in agreement. So I think you have legitimate concerns that we presented, and we're looking forward to working with the other side and making sure that we address them. And there's certainly room for negotiation and for compromise. It's just this bill right now presents a first attempt to address them.
Senator Jensen, did you have a...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Franzen, and I don't know who can come forward and help me, but when we're talking about the automobiles and the ones that are manufactured currently for B10 warranty certified, what is the difference between what has to happen with that manufacturer? What is it within the engine, or what is it that would have to change?
I think we've got a prior witness that would like to take a shot at that.
That's a long name. To answer your question, Senator, the prior vehicles mostly are pickup trucks. So in direct comparison to passenger cars, a pickup truck, for example, if it's subject to oil dilution, can put in a bigger oil pan. It's fairly easy to install bigger things in bigger vehicles. Also, they are fleet maintained. Typically, in fact, most of the OEMs who offer biodiesel capable trucks do it at the request of fleet owners. So they don't just offer them, they don't add content and cost to vehicles just because. It is because fleet owners have contacted them and said, we would like to have this capability. And as such, fleet vehicles tend to be maintained a little bit better. But passenger cars aren't. They're like toasters, and people will do dumb things with toasters. So,
what do they do with the toaster?
The Consumer Product Safety Commission has examples of toasters and bathtubs. So,
I've heard of examples before, but boy, that's a dandy, that toaster one. But
well, I got to tee one up for Steve here in case he wants to ask me a question. So,
another toaster question, Senator Jensen.
You're making me hungry.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Got to eat.
So, help me understand. It was passed in 2008. And there were some companies that made the changes that were necessary. And it's been over 5 years. How will a delay to 2020 incentivize cars to make these that I'm understanding are not, I understand it's more expensive for the auto because you have to use bigger things, but how does the delay to 2020 incentivize them to do it?
Well, actually, the manufacturers that I represent, plus my own, are working on, actually with the National Biodiesel Board, on the capability for higher blends. So it isn't that we're just standing here saying, no, we don't like it. In fact, I'll give you a good example. Mercedes-Benz was the first in the industry to have a factory fill of biodiesel. So we're not waiting for things to happen, but technology takes some time, and sometimes mandates outpace the speed of technology. In fact, it when you design and develop an engine, it isn't a 1 or 2 year thing. It takes years.
Senator Jensen, to follow up.
One follow up. So, if you're working it already, why 2020? Why not sooner?
Well, I guess the concern is that in direct contravention to what this is trying to do with increased renewable fuels. It's also been stated, too, that there are issues associated with emissions that the clean diesel technology can certainly potentially take care of. But there are some conflicting federal versus state type of mandates that we have to work through. And it's also a commercial issue as well. You know, if diesels are a small number of the small amount of the fleet, increasing, though, but still it presents, you know, a cost per vehicle type of a business case discussion. Factor into that also potential customer dissatisfaction with any type of warranty concerns. And so it gives manufacturers pause. That being said, we are working to improve the robustness to diesel fuel. At the same time, biodiesel, and also the biodiesel industry is also working to improve their product.
Mr. Chair, and I would also add, Senator Jensen, that we talked about the legacy vehicles that are still out there. So the 2020 is also taking into consideration that by then those cars might be out of, you know, operation, if you will.
Senator Dames.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like to direct this question to Bill.
Okay.
In 2008, this legislation was come up that in 2012 we'd be at 10%. How long have you been working on diesel engines that will burn 10% biodiesel fuel?
You're talking to me for the Alliance or my company in general?
Manufacturers.
So there have been very, very few passenger car diesels up until probably about 2008 or 2009. And Minnesota being, as has been stated, the only state that has been prompting a biodiesel mandate, we look at the general good and what is good, what will our sales be in the United States, and we work at a general type of population. A patchwork of mandates is really difficult to design vehicles to. So we will design vehicles for that people will buy. So if we have to put in additional content for one type of vehicle, that involves additional certification costs with the EPA, and that cost testing itself just costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. So it doesn't make financial sense to design a vehicle for one state. That's why we've moved to a national emission standard, the harmonization for Tier 3 emissions, for example, with California. We're trying to get away from green states and non-green states. We're trying to get one national standard.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. So can I take it that your answer is you probably didn't get serious about this back in 2008 when this mandate was passed? And that it's a financial issue, and so that's why we're maybe here today. And if my answer is wrong, and you've been working on it since 2008, then I would assume it would be a very short window, and we probably could meet these standards, so then we probably wouldn't have to extend them to 2020. Is there any fairness in that logic?
No, because it leaves out the truth that the biodiesel quality was pretty poor back in 2008, and they've been working on it. So the fact is that I'm not about to introduce a poor quality product into one of my vehicles. And like I said, we're working together with the National Biodiesel Board industry, but Steve can definitely attest that the biodiesel quality was very poor. And so I would not advocate putting something bad in my car. And if it was 2008, I wouldn't have advocated putting it in then. So I wouldn't design a vehicle for that.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to add, Senator Dames, it's also left out the whole scope of the consumer. If you have in your packet a disclosure form that auto dealers are sending, if you go to a place right now and look for a diesel vehicle, you're going to be handed out this disclosure that says this mandate is in place, and you might not find the fuel you need. So consumers are certainly alerted, certainly I am, as a consumer of a diesel vehicle, that had I read that disclosure, I probably wouldn't have bought the vehicle that I did. And I'm an informed citizen, I would say, on average. And I just don't believe that the consumer was really brought into this mandate's attention when it did pass. On the contrary, when we did pass the ethanol, we did have consumer protection language there. So we're just saying delay it for the consumer. The manufacturers are still working on their engines. But the bigger picture, I think the why we're here today is frankly, our constituents and our consumers.
Kasunkin and Carlson, and I think we're probably moving on.
Thank you, Senator Metzen. I wanted somebody on testify on this side to answer this question, because those that proposed that we continue to support the mandates have cited Illinois having 11% biodiesel, and yet I don't see it on your map. So I guess I want an explanation from your side of it to talk about that particular fact or whatever.
Welcome back.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, Amber Backus. Illinois does not have a mandate. It has an incentive program. Illinois, besides a fuel tax, also has a sales tax on purchases of fuel in that state. So as an incentive to increase the market share for biodiesel, the state has an incentive. If you blend B11 or higher, you don't have to charge sales tax on that fuel. And that's significant cost and savings for consumers, but cost to the state. That costs about $127 million a year for the state to have that program. But that being said, it is an incentive in the marketplace. B5 is still available to customers. I spoke with the Meijer grocery chain, which has about 17 locations in the Chicago suburbs and around Champaign, Urbana. They still make B5, or conventional diesel, doesn't even have to be B5 in Illinois. They still make that available to their customers. So there is a choice in the marketplace. If you need to find the fuel to make your vehicle work, you can there, whereas this would completely make it illegal for you to sell the fuel that's needed to work in your vehicle.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I would like to ask Bill also, what's the mode of failure that's happening here? Because we've talked about mechanical failures, and so far I haven't seen anything that's a mechanical failure. It's more of a maintenance failure.
Okay. There have been mechanical failures. So I wanted to bring a bunch of dirty parts here. Northwest or Delta doesn't allow me to do that. Saying Northwest tells you how much I've been flying recently. So the mechanical failures, we actually had oil sludging such that it plugs oil passages and you destroy engine bearings and therefore engines. But less, more benign than that, you'll have turbochargers that get oil on them, that soot caked on them. EGR valves, these exhaust gas emission valves, which add exhaust gas to help reduce NOx. You have intercoolers that can get coated with oil. So there's hardware failures that are constantly, parts are constantly getting replaced. And I would call a failure when you have to change an oil filter or a fuel filter far more often than is prescribed, as that's also a failure, because the customer has a certain expectation of a warranty cadence. And when you have to go, your vehicle starts showing a check engine light for low fuel pressure, and it's 4,000 miles, you think, I'm supposed to go 20,000 miles without even a check engine light. So there is a litany of failures in Illinois in particular, of broken engines, but also carboned up and otherwise functionally compromised hardware in the diesel engine.
And Senator Dames, our final question of the, from the – well, Carlson, did you have a follow-up?
Excuse me. What I'm hearing is that there's a lot of maintenance problems, but also most of the discussion we had was cold weather problems. The gelling, we've heard about strings before. We've heard about algae. We've heard a lot of other complaints about biodiesel. But I'm under the understanding that a lot of those have been solved. And when we talk about Illinois, I think we've got some documentation here that says that 55% of the stations are selling 11 or 10% or above.
Plus, we have a letter from Volkswagen that says that they're going to warrant the Volkswagen engines to 20%. So they're assuring their customers that this is not a problem.
Well, that they're doing that because I've actually had conversation with the Volkswagen person since they're part of the alliance. They do that because they want to protect their customers. They sell, some of their models are 50% diesels. So they don't want customers not buying their product because of concern over the ability to find fuel and also the concern of having a warranty denied. So they are looking at it and saying, okay, we will protect you because we understand you can't find the fuel. They're not volunteering to warranty the vehicles. And then the customer is the happenstance. They are saying, okay, we understand the bad situation there and we're doing our best to protect you. Regarding maintenance issues, the rate of maintenance issues and also hardware failures is much higher in Illinois than where we sell with other diesel populations. So we don't experience sludged engines of the same. If you have one sludge engine or two sludge engines in the United States, that's a big deal. We have two of them in the same state. That is pretty catastrophic, at least from a manufacturer's perspective. Engines are supposed to last for 300,000 miles, and when they break at 15 and 20,000 miles and it's traceable back to the fuel, that's problematic. One or two out of 20,000 or 30,000, it's still very, very problematic.
Senator Dames, you get the final question.
Question was answered. Thank you, okay. Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to head to the opponents, and it's going to be exactly 45 minutes. We went 5 minutes over time here, but that's not bad. So we'll go to 2:15. Yeah, that's a poor leadership. I let it go 5 minutes. You know, Kasauka's my dear friend, has to point that out.
But we were on.
No more bills this session.
Do you have bills on the schedule? We have a first opponent on this issue, Jerry Schoenfeld, Minnesota Biodiesel Council. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I do represent the Minnesota Biodiesel Council, and I also work with Minnesota Soybean Growers. Mr. Chairman, it's very difficult to answer all the allegations that you get here in a few 40 minutes, but I do want to point out that these same allegations have been made time and time and time again in the past. And there is more to it than what is generally first put out there. First of all, I want to tell you a little bit about the reasons for the biodiesel in the first place. Part of the reason that some legislators voted for this, the original B2 mandate, then the B5 and the B10, was the fact that it was diversification of the fuel supply. I mean, this country's fought a couple of wars over oil. This country has had situations with hurricanes in which we did not have enough fuel in this part of the country. As a matter of fact, some years ago, I remember after Hurricane Katrina, it was indicated to me by the head of the Petroleum Marketers Association that it had not been for biodiesel, we would never got crop out of the field in the fall because there wasn't enough diesel supply in the area at the time. Secondly, air quality, and I think later the American Lung Association is going to speak to air quality and the fact that biodiesel has a 50% or greater reduction. It's the only fuel recognized by the United States government and the EPA as having a 50% or greater reduction in greenhouse gases. It reduces particulates, hydrocarbons, and carbon monoxide. Thirdly, yes, the economy. I do represent farmers, and in fact, in Minnesota's economy, because of studies that we've done to show what increase in biodiesel, just within Minnesota, it adds approximately $1 billion worth of value to the farm economy each year. And remember, this is this being the Commerce Committee, that is part of commerce as well. And lastly, even in some cases, benefits to engines. You've heard about problems that people have with certain kinds of engines and so forth, but it also does provide some additional lubricity that changed with the change of the ULSD. For instance, where sulfur was taken out of the fuel by the federal government and biodiesel helped replace some of the lubricity in there. It has a higher cetane rating and is cleaner burning. But I want to, first of all, before I get into kind of refuting some of the things that you've heard, talk a little about the history of biodiesel being on trial, in a sense. And in a sense, that's kind of what happens ahead of our legislative committees. In a sense, we have issues that are on trial.
And in terms of biodiesel, the first probably happened with the federal government almost 20 years ago, in which health effects were taken a look at by the federal government and the EPA and something called EPACT, in which they approved B20 as the only fuel, alternative fuel that met their specifications. In the year 2000 to 2002, we had 2 years of discussion in this legislature, both in the House and the Senate, about biodiesel. All of the same arguments were brought up. Through that process, at least the legislature at that time, having heard those arguments, felt that it was important to put biodiesel into effect. And you must remember at that time there was no biodiesel industry to speak of. I believe the author of the bill indicated that 25 million gallons were produced in 2002, and today, or last year, 1.8 billion gallons being produced. So there is a lot of field trials as such, if you want to look at it in that way. Three different administrations in Minnesota have scrutinized biodiesel. Interestingly enough, they've been independent Republican and Democrat. The first biodiesel bill was scrutinized and passed under Governor Ventura. The second one was proposed to move to B10, B20 by a Republican governor, Governor Pawlenty, and the third, Governor Dayton, has stood in support of the biodiesel. One of the interesting things to me, too, is that, for instance, I know that one of the commenters here earlier today talked about the fact that they had not opposed it in 2008. As a matter of fact, they helped write the legislation in 2008 along with all these other opponents. And, Mr. Chairman, I have to ask a question here because I may have done something wrong here in the sense that I have got some handouts, but I didn't hand them out to you in advance, so I don't know if I can now or not.
Right.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to do that if I could, and then I'll quickly get on. One of the things that I've done here is I have shown the existing law and the proposed changes and what the reason that there was an existing law, because sometimes we kind of forget the reason that some of the existing law was put in place. When it was originally passed, the same people that are opposing us today, for the most part, with one exception, and that is the auto retailers and Auto Alliance, the same people asked that we delay the implementation dates of all of the biodiesel mandates. Governor Pawlenty had requested at the time he wanted to put biodiesel mandate 20% year-round in 2008. That was his proposal. Representing the soybean growers, we oppose that, which you may find kind of odd, but in fact we oppose it because we agreed that some things were not quite ready at that time. And so because of that, we did oppose it at that time, and these delayed implementation dates were part of the negotiated agreement between a whole lot of people, and I'll stand and say that not everybody, including us, got everything we wanted, and that's the way it works around here. But we did have delayed implementation dates, and it was delayed until 2012, and in addition to that, we put in a provision that said that there was a way for the commissioners of PCA in Commerce and the Department of Ag to take public testimony, in a sense, through the Biodiesel Task Force, because there are public people involved in that, maybe not in the same way that it is in this legislature, but certainly to take comments and to be able to delay it if they didn't feel it was ready. And they did so, 2 more years. So not only there was a negotiated delayed implementation date originally, but in addition to that, it was delayed 2 more years by the commissioner. One of the things that was made a comment of was that there was no consideration in any of this legislation for the consumer. That simply isn't true, and that both with both the consumer and with regard to the people that make the vehicles, the OEMs, part of that was the discussion at the time was we need to take a look, and we won't even consider B10 or B20 unless we get an ASTM specification. ASTM International is the group that basically certifies fuel and many, many other things in the world as to the specifications required
It is composed of 128 nations with technical support from those countries that take a look at the standards. In the case of fuel, all fuel is ASTM certified in a sense. Beyond that, individual states have to adopt it into their laws. And, Mr. Chairman, one of the bills that you put through today earlier, I believe probably had some of those ASTM certifications. I didn't look at it, but my guess is it was a department bill, so it probably did. Those ASTM certifications are intended to watch out for the idea that if there is a fuel that is manufactured, it is fuel that is manufactured to such specifications that indeed it works in the vehicles that we have. And so one of the caveats or one of the delays that was required before we could go into effect was the ASTM specification. I believe that that's a consumer situation as well. Prior to 2008, we did not have that ASTM specifications. In 2008, we created an ASTM specification that is made for B5 and also for B6 through 20. So there's two different specifications there. That ASTM specification is done by ballot, by individuals that are part of a technical committee. It includes people like the OEMs. It includes people like fuel manufacturers. It includes people like distributors, a broad array of technical people. And for 2 years, they went over the biodiesel situation and took a look at that and came up with their specifications. Now, occasionally, those specifications are changed because we find some new evidence or some new information or whatever. But the one of the things I would tell you is that one single negative vote on that ASTM committee will prevent you from obtaining the ASTM specification, a single vote. And yet, when biodiesel on trial ahead of the ASTM committee for 2 years, it was, in fact, approved, both for B5 and also for B6 through 20. Beyond that, in 2012, this legislation came before this, body for the third time since 2002. And at that time, there was a look at the extension of the exceptions that took place. You heard from the railroads, from the mining and logging, that they want to see this extended or the sunset eliminated. And in fact, we have agreed in the past to doing that because the reason the sunset was put out there in the first place was the idea that we hoped that by having the sunset, it would encourage the railroads and the mines and the loggers to take a look at this. Now, I will tell you that one of the things I am very happy about today is, and I'm going to give kudos to the logging industry, because they pointed out in their letter to you that, in fact, they had trouble with fuel that had biodiesel. They also had trouble with fuel that did not have biodiesel. And, in fact, there is sometimes trouble with fuel in Minnesota for a number of different reasons. But in any case, we have not stated. Matter of fact, we've told one of the co-authors of this bill, matter of fact, several probably, that when the extensions become due, which is next year, that we would probably support extending those extensions for those exceptions, because we would agree at this point in time that still we have not gotten to the point on those particular items, and that's why we supported it in the past. Beyond that, there was also the fact that on the federal government level, not only the state of Minnesota, not only about 30 other states in the country that have taken a look at biodiesel mandates and incentives and passed them, but in addition to that, when you take a look on the federal level, that we have something called RFS2, the Renewable Fuel Standard. And the Renewable Fuel Standard was put into play by Congress in 2005. And many of these same people that are standing here today opposing us in Minnesota have opposed the fuel standard in the past and are continuing to oppose the fuel standard on the federal level. And part of this discussion is not just about Minnesota. It is also about the ability to point to Minnesota, which has been the leader in renewable fuels, and say, look, even Minnesota is reversing itself. Now help us out in Congress to reverse it on the federal level. RFS2 was passed in 2005. RFS1, RFS2, the second renewable fuel standard, was passed in 2007, and because of that, there is a lot of fuel. There's a fuel requirement by the federal government that a certain amount of biodiesel must be in place through the fuel supply. In addition to that, B20 approval by American vehicle companies, we've taken a look at a number of them. I believe that there are 28. I think I will stand to be corrected on this, but I believe that the discussion centers that there are 28 vehicles in Minnesota right now that have got diesel that are diesel vehicles. And I believe 20 of the 28, all made by American manufacturers, are and approved. That includes passenger cars such as the Chevy Cruze, which I think is the only passenger car, but the passenger cars such as the Chevy Cruze, which approves B20, and in addition to that, the other American-made vehicles in terms of trucks and so forth, pickup trucks. There's been 20 years of testing by the National Renewable Energy Laboratories, multiple tests done by universities, private testing, and also by the Department of Energy. In 2003, the Biodiesel Task Force was established. It includes producers, oil company representatives, truckers, University of Minnesota, Ag Utilization Research Institute, and others. The department, and they have reviewed biodiesel since 2003. And when they found problems like the Cold Weather Task Force, they were fixed. Things were changed, standards were improved, and they were fixed. Beyond that, we've had Department of Agriculture, PCA, and Commerce overviewing biodiesel for all of these years. We have gone through 14 legislative committees over the years. And it wasn't for just 20 or 40 minutes. They were hours and hours of testimony. Worldwide use, there's B7 used as a standard in Europe, RFS2 in the United States, B10 is required in Argentina, B20 is required in Costa Rica, B10 over time will happen in Ecuador, and even with the mining operations, in Indonesia, 25 mining operations are required by their country to use biodiesel. We talked about B11 in Illinois since 2003, and yes, 55% of their total fuel is B11 or higher. We suspect that in the wintertime they drop that percentage, so probably in the summertime it's higher than 55%. Last year's usage, as I said, 1.8 billion gallons in the United States. In 2002, we were told warranties would be voided. It would not, and these were the things we were told, and you could go back in the record and you would find them for other legislative hearings and committees. And these were the things that were stated. Warranties would be voided. In fact, I'm at least not aware of any warranty that was voided just by the sole use of biodiesel. It is true that if biodiesel were to cause the problem, then a warranty would not need to be standing up, because warranties for engines are based upon parts and workmanship. They do not warrant fuel. However, we think that we have a product that does not cause this kind of a problem. It would not be available, was secondly. In fact, we've created a system in Minnesota where it is available everywhere. Prices would skyrocket. There would not be a significant economic impact. Matter of fact, the truckers at that time ordered a study done that showed by a university economist that there would be no positive economic impact. But in fact, today we have over $1 billion a year positive economic impact, and that's only in agriculture, not the supporting groups that support biodiesel. We created a statewide distribution system available to everyone, in spite of the fact of the arguments at the time, we did not drive prices through the roof. In fact, when this bill was introduced, it put a mandate in reverse, and it said that there would be no more than 5% biodiesel allowed in Minnesota. That's what the original bill said. We were told it was a drafting error, and so today's amendment changes that, and that is no longer the case within the bill as the amendment was adopted. However, one of the reasons we believe that that was not acceptable to some of the people of the opposition coalition was the fact that throughout the summertime, fuel retailers have been selling 10 and 20% biodiesel because it was a significant profit for them to do so. And in fact, throughout most of the summer, biodiesel was cheaper than regular diesel at higher blends. There's a whole system of pricing involved with biodiesel, and it takes an awful lot to get into, so I'm not going to do that right now unless there's a question about it. But In addition to that, we've produced good jobs in three different production plants that have made biodiesel readily available in the state and throughout the nation. We've helped to reduce air pollution, and as the American Lung Association will speak later, to prevent non-attainment in our cities. We have gained ASTM approval for B5, B6 through 20, and for B100 at a base level, and we are recognized by EPA as a legal fuel. I assume EPA also did their studies. In addition, we have gained B100 approval by Case IH, Deutz, Fairbanks Morse, and New Holland. In addition, have gained B20 approval from Arctic Cat, Bueller, and of 20 of 28 light-duty trucks and passenger vehicles sold in the United States. 20 are B20 approved by Ford, GM, Chrysler. Additionally, HDT USA Motorcycles, Hino Trucks, International Navistar, Isuzu Commercial Trucks, John Deere, Kubota, Mack, Perkins, Tomcar, Toro, Volvo Trucks, and Yanmar all approved B20. All of these manufacturers have done the testing and made whatever minor modifications they saw fit to support B20 or higher in order to be ready for the higher blend policies by states and local governments in the United States and throughout the world. In Minnesota, we've also learned from problems that we've had and have protocols and standards in place to ensure quality, such as BQ9000 for quality controls at our plants so that we can deliver a quality fuel approved by EPA, accredited by the ASTM International, and controlled by specifications in both Minnesota law and overseen by the Department of Commerce. And they'll be up later, and you can ask them about their oversight. As I stated before, Minnesota law had a 4-year delayed enactment date, and then was delayed for 2 more years. In 2012, Governors Dayton and Branstad, and I could pass that out to the committee as well, put out their letter, Governor's letter.
Jerry, my friend, we've got 10 more witnesses, and I'm sure they've got something to add.
I'm the big kebab on this one, Senator, in terms of trying to answer some of this. But I will shorten it up. But I would ask that this letter be passed out.
We'll get that out, but from
the Midwest Governors Conference, in which they sent a letter to the OEMs telling them that this was coming, telling them that it was important to the policies of these states in the Midwest to have this, and they'd like it to be taken care of.
Let me just add that we know that there will be at least 2 more committees to hear this and possibly 3, so it's not like anybody's...
Mr. Chairman, that's making an assumption. It's passing out of this committee. I hope that's not necessary.
I don't know that.
In any case, the point is, so why are we here? Because in spite of the fact that the biodiesel industry met all of the requirements in the law, which were put there at the request of opponents to biodiesel, in spite of the fact that we have had millions of miles over the road experience at different levels of biodiesel usage, in spite of the fact that our mandate has driven biodiesel much throughout the United States, in spite of the fact that we had 4 years plus 2 delayed implementation, people don't feel they're ready. What we have found, and the question was asked earlier today, Mr. Chairman, what will it do to delay it? We've had delays over and over and over, and we have not seen any more positive in some cases. For instance, with the railroads, with the mines. We've had those delays, and we haven't come together. Now, Mr. Chairman, I do, in fact, have a bunch more that I could say, but we do have others, and I'll stop.
I appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, with us is Hoon Ji, who is one of our technical fuel experts.
Okay, sure. We've got about 25 more minutes. Welcome to the committee.
Sure. I'll make it quick. Again, my name is Hoon Ji. Thanks for letting me speak here. First of all, Senator next to me, I'm just like her. I just bought a Volkswagen Passat last September. Been running on B20, no issues. I also own a legacy vehicle, 1999 Chevy Suburban. Quarter million miles, there's no issues running B20. But besides that, what we do is our company, we run a national biodiesel helpline. So anybody who's got a problem with biodiesel, perceived biodiesel problems, they could call our 800 number. And then what we try to do is what caused that problem. They send the fuel samples to us. They send the filter samples. And basically, we sit there and make sure that we actually tell people, is that a fuel related? Is that a handling issue? Or is that a biodiesel related? Again, John's right over there with from Minnesota Trucking. He even put on his newsletter, if there's anybody has a problem with the biodiesel, he posts our number, 800 number. We'll probably got about a handful of calls this year. So, again, One of the things that people talk about here, we're here to talk about B10 mandate, but a lot of people keep talking about cold weather issues. Diesel fuel, I don't know if you guys, it's shocking or not, diesel fuel is not meant to run in the winter by itself. I could guarantee you that. I worked for a company called Coke Refining since 1987 to 97. And back then, everything happened to diesel issue. They blame bad diesel fuel. Again, all of a sudden, biodiesel comes along, we become another poster child to blame everything else. But I could just sit here and guarantee you, temperature below zero, you're not going to run 100% number two without heating the system or number one or additive. It's physically impossible to run diesel fuel without having some other information. So, we're talking about B10 mandate. And I want to kind of basically give you a couple, dispute some of the information that I've been hearing here. Again, if I'm stepping on somebody's toe, I apologize. I'm always a technical guy. I'm not a politician. So basically what I want to say is that, again, people talk about high price. I have a price right here, today's price, from two different sources, two larger refiners. B5 costs penny more, and other refiners actually cost less on B5. So people come up with all this number by high cost. Again, anybody wants to dispute that, I'd be glad to show this. And again, I also have a friend that is in the fuel distributor business. If anybody wants to buy B20 today, I'll guarantee it's less than diesel fuel if you want to buy truckload, which is 7,000 gallons. So we need to put that myth, basically saying that biodiesel costs more. We don't think that's true. Again, earlier someone mentioned about how we lost dollar gallon credit. Because RFS2, right now, the actual biodiesel price is less than diesel fuel. So, people need to get it from fact from and from the, and him the myth. So here, anybody want to ever ask questions? We have an 800 number that we could call you and tell you that where you get help on technical issue.
Okay, next up, the Department of Ag.
Thanks so much for timing this issue. My name is Charlie Polster. I'm the assistant commissioner. I guess it'd be the little kebab to Gary's large kebab. We're going to try and go quickly because we do have a lot of other folks that are also going to testify. I do want to say that we actually have some biodiesel here from REG and Albert Lee. This summer, they invested $23 million in their plant here in our state, in large part because we do have a standard. We're viewed as an excellent market. This is really an important issue to all Minnesotans. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture, along with PCA and Commerce, believe that the law on the books works well. It benefits the state as a whole, economically and environmentally. First, let's talk about value. Blending biodiesel, which is a renewable transportation fuel, is good for rural Minnesota. It adds value to the second largest commodity crop that our farmers grow, soybeans. On average, it adds 73 cents to each bushel of soybeans here in Minnesota. Also, biodiesel plants make a worthwhile contribution to our livestock industry, pushing down soy meal in the area where there are plants. The biodiesel industry, as Jerry said, adds nearly $1 billion to Minnesota's economy. We have three plants within the state that produce roughly 65 million gallons of biodiesel a year. The other large benefit that I think we should talk about is air quality, the environmental portion. Biodiesel is a much cleaner alternative to petroleum-based diesel. It qualifies as an advanced biofuel under the RFS. That means it's a 50% reduction in greenhouse gases compared to petroleum. It also significantly reduces particulate matter when you compare it to straight diesel, helping improve our air quality in the metro. The Twin Cities Metro is nearly out of attainment with the Federal Clean Air Act, and using more biodiesel will help us delay that. Biodiesel is a safe, effective, and reliable renewable fuel. It has worked well for both rural and urban Minnesota. We look forward to building on our success. Minnesota's always been a leader. We were the first state to have an ethanol mandate, and I think that we should continue to push forward with our biodiesel industry. This is a big tent that's supported by both Minnesota Farmers Union, Farm Bureau, our Minnesota corn growers and soybean growers, but also organizations like the American Lung Institute and the Urban Air Initiative. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture does host the Biodiesel Task Force. This is a series of industry representatives, including folks from Flint Hills, the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association, Magellan, the Minnesota Truckers Association. And 2 years ago, when we feel like we hadn't met statute, we delayed a year at their recommendation because we didn't have blending in the southwest part of the state. We came back in 1 year, and they made the recommendation that we had met the 4 points of the law and it was time to move forward. We followed statute, and the commissioner, my boss, also followed the recommendation of the biodiesel task force. So again, we think this is a sound policy to move forward. It's good for rural Minnesota, and it does give us some comfort that we're not the first state to go here. As we talked about Illinois, 55% of their fuel is at B11 or higher, and their Department of Agriculture estimates that over 7 billion miles have been driven on B11 or higher. And they stated on the record that they have not had a single engine failure due to higher blends of biodiesel. That gives us a lot of confidence that the product we produce here in state is of the highest quality and that we won't have any problems implementing that. With that, I would turn it to Santo Cruz.
For the record, Santo Cruz, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I just want to, with the limited time we have left, just make a couple of points. Biodiesel is a domestic product that improves energy independence and supports the U.S. economy. But don't take my word for it. That is from Mercedes-Benz. As you can see, this is from, you can own and drive a Mercedes-Benz diesel in the state of Illinois. I think that a lot of the tactics that we're seeing here today have been played out in Illinois already, and this is just act two of the same story. Similarly, I just want to touch quickly on the issue of warranties. I met with Senator Metzen. She was kind enough to meet with me and Assistant Commissioner Poster. And the Magnuson-Moss Act is a federal statute which requires the manufacturer to bear the burden of proof. And we've had that said incorrectly, I think, 3 or 4 times today. People have said, well, you know, the consumer's going to have to prove that it wasn't the biodiesel. It's flipped around the other way. And I've before I worked at the Department of Agriculture, I was with the Department of Commerce as one of their attorneys. I dealt with this issue of the Magnuson-Moss Act. Some of the warnings you're seeing, I know that may be under review through the Attorney General's office if it's misleading to consumers. But absolutely, the warranties remain in place until the manufacturer proves that the biodiesel or the fuel is what caused the malfunction or problem. So just to clear up 2 misconceptions and misstatements of the law on the record, other than that, we will stand
for
questions.
Mr. Cruz, do you have another witness that you're familiar with, or did he just sit on up there? No, you're welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Steve Howell. I work for a small consulting company called Mark IV, okay. And I serve as the technical advisor, senior technical advisor for the National Biodiesel Board. So I wanted to address some technical points here. My role in the industry, I chair the ASTM Biodiesel Task Force on the biodiesel standards. So in that role, it's my job to work with the engine companies, the petroleum companies, and all the ASTM voters to make sure that the standards put into place are protective of consumers and that work well in engines. After all, from a biodiesel industry perspective, if the fuel does not work in an engine, people will not buy the fuel. So it's absolutely critical that the fuel work in the engines and that they work to the expectations of both engine customers and fuel customers. That's what the ASTM process is about. And we started that process in 1993. We passed our first B100 standard in the year 2001. We passed our first B20 standard and B5 standard in the year 2008. So as part of that process, as Mr. Schoenfeld alluded to earlier, every engine company, every petroleum company gets a vote, and one negative vote can overrule the passage of a ballot, and you have to have a 2/3 supermajority to override that. So that's part and parcel to the process and the research that's gone into this product, is that everybody gets a vote, and we're constantly improving those standards as we see new fuels in the marketplace and as we see new engines. The new engines of today are dramatically different than they were in 2008, than they were in 2004. You know, when ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel was adopted in 2006, the engines before that time were not designed for ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel. You know, so that's a similar situation that we're in today. What we've done with the biodiesel standards, and we work very cooperatively with all of the engine companies. I'm in constant contact with Mr. Webkenberg and others from the OEMs to make sure we're running testing programs and designing things so the engines are going to work. We are at the standpoint right now where we have B-20 formal acceptance with, as Mr. Schoenfeld said earlier, 20 of 28 diesel manufacturers now approve of B-20 in all or portion of their diesel fleet. That's about 75% across the board for all the manufacturers. Less light duty because they're newer on the market. We have 90% right now of the medium and heavy duty engine companies where most of the diesel fuel is used that support B-20 in their equipment. So that's where we put most of our effort, where we've spent a lot of our time. So what we've done is we've looked at the ASTM specs. Are they set right? And then we've looked at fuel quality. Are people meeting the specs? And that's two very important things, some things that we've learned and that we're continuing to work on. You heard comments from Illinois where there were some potential engine sludging, some other engine-related issues. It's our firm belief that those issues happening in Illinois, to the extent that they really are true, those are happening not due to good in-spec biodiesel that meets the ASTM standards. Those are because people using raw vegetable oil or other products that don't meet the standards, that have no ASTM standards, that have no research behind them. We're in cooperative programs now to look at each one of those to see if it was really biodiesel or is it one of these other products that are out there that people are using that isn't biodiesel at all, and it's really that that's causing the problem out there in the marketplace today.
All right, good. Mr. Brinkman, did you have a retort or something about something that was said? Or
Mr. Chairman, Peter Brickwitty from the Department of Commerce. I'll be very brief. Just want to provide some clarification to members about some comments from earlier regarding sales of fuel from out of state into Minnesota. The Department of Commerce is the regulator amongst the agencies here that are involved in the biodiesel mandate. And so I'd be happy to answer any questions about the regulatory environment and the enforcement mechanisms that our Weights and Measures Division has at their disposal to make sure that Minnesota consumers and end users receive mandate-compliant fuel. But I'd just like to clarify that the obligation for complying with the law is on whoever provides the fuel to the end user, regardless of whether or not they are a Minnesota-based company or from out of state. And so out-of-state fuel is supposed to comply with Minnesota law. The Weights and Measures Division and the Commerce Department have regulatory authority to take action and have taken action against out-of-state suppliers who have provided non-compliant fuel into Minnesota. And I would like to thank all of you, actually, as we clarified that regulatory authority in last year's Weights and Measures bill. I would also just very quickly like to show folks, this is the very first draft, came off the press this week, of Weights and Measures Be Ready for B10 flyer, which is being developed in consultation with the Petroleum Marketers Association, and we'll be using this as a tool to educate both retailers and consumers about the B10 mandate in the coming months to make sure that consumers understand what this means and understand, also retailers understand what the labeling requirements are so that they can properly provide disclosure to consumers about what product they're about to put in their vehicle. It's not ready for prime time, but I had the first draft, so I wanted to show it to folks. Be happy to share it with members when it's finalized later this year. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Scott Hendrick and Ron Marr, please come up together and welcome to the...
I would be Scott Hedrick. I can't be two people at once, although it would be helpful sometimes for my wife.
I just don't know what kind of remarks. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear it all. Were they against the chair or something? Or what? I think we're going to welcome you to the committee. Welcome to the committee.
I'm Terrell Anderson. I'm standing in for Ron Marr.
Okay, well, I don't know all of that because it's not on the sheet, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Scott Hedrick. I'm with Renewable Energy Group. I've got a couple colleagues with me here today. I'm based in Iowa, and I'm always a little bit leery being an Iowegian coming up here, so I did bring some Minnesotans who work in our Albert Lea facility. I asked if you could look at a sample because apparently I didn't realize this till the start of the hearing, but I work for the evil empire. We are the root of all evil. We will be devastating every diesel engine that's in this state and bringing economic ruin to Minnesota, or at least if you buy some of the rhetoric. What you're looking at is a sample of our fuel from our Albert Lea facility, a facility in the last 4 years we've put in over $60 million. We employ nearly 30 folks at that facility. That facility touches an additional 800 to 900 jobs in the region. We purchase somewhere in the tune of $125 million worth of feedstocks from 26 different vendors here in Minnesota. Those are real numbers. Those impact real people, like Brian Christiansen, who's our plant manager, and Zane Brock, who's one of our employees. They impact the folks in community in Albert Lea. They impact the state. And I think it's important to note that. This is a great opportunity today, and clearly you've heard an awful lot of emotion from a number of folks on both sides of this, and I wish there was more time to discuss it more fully. We certainly should be having a discussion around these issues. There's lots of points that were brought up that are very valid. We should be looking at the exemption issues around logging and mining. We've been working with those folks for some time, including the railroad industry. They raise good points. We should talk about them. But this
way, Senator Kosalka, did you wish to?
Yeah, if I can, Mr. Chair, to the testifier, I mean, I lean towards the ag position on this, but I do want a clarification. You said that jobs would be impacted if this passed, because it still remains at B5, correct? And so how would jobs be impacted?
It does, but we've made a significant investment in upgrade into that facility to keep it running. And you're looking at a time and place now where, because of uncertainty in Washington, D.C., there's a lot of uncertainty in the biodiesel industry. And as you heard, our industry produced probably about 1.8 billion gallons in 2013. We'll produce less this year due to the uncertainties in Washington. As companies look to operate, we want to make sure that we're operating in states that have great public policy in place that give us support.
Okay. Thank you. Need further discussion?
I want to point out that if this bill is meant to sit down and have an open and honest dialogue with the biodiesel industry, it's sort of like coming to your house with a steamroller and running it down and saying we're knocking on the door. There are lots of opportunities to discuss here, but this legislation goes far, far beyond. It caps everything for a what if or a maybe or a we think there might be issues. I'm a little bit loath to bring this up because I think this will probably cut close to some folks here, but we hear about things like legacy vehicles and our customer satisfaction from the same industry that won't invest $7 in a part in order to fix a vehicle to save lives. That's a real issue. That's valid. And you all are going to have to weigh some concerns here in terms of what represents a real and meaningful question about what we want to do for our consumers and what represents rhetoric and smoke and mirrors. We think this bill goes too far, not needed. There are lots of areas where we can work on agreement, but this is not it.
Let me just say that I'm convinced it's going to have another 6 or 8 hours of hearings. And there's time to, if there's a fix, there's plenty of time, there's some time to do that. Okay? We're not, I mentioned earlier, there's probably three more committees that are probably each going to take 2 hours or 3 hours like we did today. Sir, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Terrell Anderson. I'm the CEO at Minnesota Soybean Processors down in Brewster, Minnesota. We are a soybean crushing and biodiesel facility. We have 2,400 farmer members that back in 2005 and 2008 invested over $45 million to build the soybean crushing and the biodiesel facility based on the current legislation. This current bill severely limits what would, I think would be used in Minnesota. It puts all the power in the people that don't want to use it. Right now, we employ about 85 employees at our plant. 15 are directly related to biodiesel. We have $4.5 million payroll, $1 million in benefits, and all this depends on biodiesel. Without the biodiesel, we would no longer be a farmer-owned cooperative at this time. Just this last week, we are passing out $6 million to our members in dividends based on our profits on the biodiesel side, and that is our best year ever. It has been a struggle. I guess my main point, a lot of this stuff has already been said, so I'm not going to repeat that. I would like to say as far as the legacy vehicles, I have two of them. I run 99% biodiesel when I can get it, and I have no issues, and the exhaust does not smell. No issues fuel filters, no issues with anything. It actually runs better. That's all.
Thank you. We have John Hunter. Kurt Kadelka. Welcome. And we have one very, actually the time is up, but I think the committee will indulge you. There's these two folks, the two after that, then we're done. Yeah. So we will extend it another 5 minutes or so. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Minson and members. My name is John Hunter. I'm representing the American Lung Association in Minnesota. We appreciate the opportunity to speak very quickly on this, and I'm going to shrink this down even a little bit more since Assistant Commissioner Kadelka is going to be talking a bit about the health cost impacts and that side of things. But real quickly, since we've been mentioned a couple times, just wanted to highlight what some of the actual health impacts are that biodiesel benefits, and just to state that we support the progress to B10 this summer for air quality purposes. Because biodiesel does burn significantly cleaner than traditional petroleum diesel, particularly in older engines that are not retrofitted with the filters. So to get to, I guess, right quick, the particular benefits of biodiesel include fine particulate matter, otherwise known as PM2.5, as well as some of the ozone precursors. And this can lead to those types of pollutants can lead to asthma attacks, difficulty breathing, increased susceptibility to respiratory illness, permanent lung damage, stroke, heart disease, and even premature death. And even the sort of momentary impacts can have lasting consequences. For example, asthma attacks are a leading medical cause for missed school for children. And of course, when a child misses a class, that means a parent is probably going to be less productive at work as they're taking care of their child. And the science is constantly improving and showing some of these impacts. For example, last October, the World Health Organization's International Agency for Research on Cancer declared fine particulate matter carcinogenic. So working with the National Biodiesel Board, we were able to do some estimations of what the B10 would result for as far as air pollution impacts in Minnesota. And so B10 running April through October in Minnesota would result in an extra 65 tons of particulate matter reduced, 85 tons of hydrocarbons reduced, and 275,000 tons of fewer greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota each year. And that takes into account the fact that newer engines tend to have some of the filters that already get some of these kind of things, but the legacy vehicles on the road are really where a lot of those pollution benefits come from. So with that, as mentioned earlier, too, the Metro Transit was running B20 this summer, but they did it because it saved them money. Minnesotans got cleaner air, but they got to use fewer public dollars for using B20 all summer. So we ask that you support the existing law. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is opposed to the changes in the biodiesel content statute. Biodiesel is an important tool in combating air pollution and its negative impacts on human health and the economy. Many times the benefits of biodiesel, the discussion here is focused on rural Minnesota and its economy. Increased biodiesel is just as important for urban and suburban parts of the state and its economy and health. The Twin Cities metropolitan area, as mentioned before, is on the border of non-attainment, which means it's not meeting its federal health standard for air quality for fine particulate matter. If the Twin Cities was to move into that area, we would find ourselves in a different regulatory system, and we would have to show how we could meet the federal standards. Much of the East Coast, Chicago, Milwaukee, and others are already in this non-attainment status. The region would need to put together a plan to reduce pollution and implement programs to achieve it. In 1999, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce estimated the cost to be over $200 million a year for the metropolitan area. That number was reaffirmed a year ago by the Clean Air Dialogues, which includes such diverse groups as the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy and the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, which also saw similar dollar amounts if we were to move into non-attainment. To build on just quickly on the health impacts, why we're concerned is about half of Minnesota's air pollution problems come from fuels in the vehicles and equipment that use them. It's no longer the smokestacks, the point sources, which are the heavy contributors. Minnesota, using models through the EPA, estimates health impacts for fine particulate matters is $14 billion in premature deaths and nearly $150 million in health impacts because of fine particulate matter. biodiesel and its reductions that Mr. Hunter mentioned in fine particulate matter and other items helps reduce those costs. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, the last witnesses will be Doug Peterson, Farmers Union, Kevin Papp from the Farm Bureau.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Papp. I'm a fourth-generation farmer in Blue Earth County. I'm also president of Minnesota Farm Bureau. Minnesota Farm Bureau is the largest farm organization in the state with nearly 30,000 member families. I really only want to talk about two things. I think everything I've learned in the last 53 years as far as fuel, I can say in less than 10 words. Good fuel is good, bad fuel is bad. It's as simple as that. It's all about the fuel. And I think we can't come to the place where we want to put any kind of fuel in any kind of vehicle or every vehicle, whether it's the fuel. My 23-year-old is putting in a brand-new tractor this morning with a Tier 4 engine, or the fuel I put in 20 years ago or 40 years ago. We know that in the winter we have to have different fuel. We know we can't put gas in a diesel engine and diesel in a gas engine. But I guess if I had to say one word that kind of sums up my feelings of today, and as the Minnesota Farm Bureau president sit on the biodiesel task force, that word would be frustrated. You know, I've been the first one to say I don't want to go to another meeting. But as farmers, as Minnesotans, we know that we can work it together, work it out, get together, work it out. We've heard a lot of words today. Negotiations, compromise, working out, it's more complicated, more research, expected concerns, unhappy, cold months, filters plugging, things like that. But I'm frustrated as the biodiesel. Why weren't some of these things, and those members are here in this committee room, why didn't we talk about this more as the biodiesel task force? That's been around for a long time, and they need to run through that. So, frustrated a little bit as a biodiesel task force member, as we talked about these things 2 years ago, we weren't ready. We asked for a delay. We talked about them this year. Why weren't they brought up at that meeting? And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Chairman Metzen, and Senators. I'm, for the record, I'm Doug Peterson, President of the Minnesota Farmers Union. And we're a strong supporter of biodiesel, and we rise in opposition to this legislation. The frankness of the issue, ladies and gentlemen, this is not unlike some of the years when I sat as a legislator in some of the seats that you may sit in and some of the arguments that we had on ethanol in the state of Minnesota. I was one of the chief sponsors of the ethanol legislation in the state of Minnesota during my tenure, and I also was a co-author with Representative at that time, Tory Westrum, a Republican, on the B2 legislation. And I may report to you that all of the things that we heard during the ethanol and in the 2002 legislation are very much in parallel. And I may also add that my wheels didn't fall off my car. I was putting E85 in cars that were told to me by industry, you can't be able to do that, all of those types of things. So we've heard a lot of the arguments before. It's kind of interesting, I think, that, you know, we have a responsibility to the state of Minnesota and to its citizens, not only to the rural people, but also to the metropolitan people. Clean air, the non-attainment was talked about. We can clean the air up with renewable fuels. And we have a responsibility, ladies and gentlemen and senators, to be part of the solutions. And that's clean fuel, that's economy for rural, and it's good health for people that are in the metropolitan area. We have had, and I don't want to spend a lot of time, we have had the biodiesel task force, and we have had opportunities to hear from the opposition. None has come forward. So it's a little disconcerting in the process of preparing testimony when people would not come forward with those kinds of things. But I just want to say one thing in closing, and I think it's important that we understand this. Frankness of the matter, ladies and gentlemen, senators, that we as a state of Minnesota, as elected representatives, should not let go of our responsibility, abdicate our responsibility for good policy in rural areas, on business and economy, good policy for clean, fresh air, and frankness of it, we should not advocate on the side of the big oil companies because they're not here at the table. We have a renewable resource in Minnesota. We need to move forward with that. Thank you.
That's any quick questions of the witnesses and Senator Franzen or Senator Pratt. Did you have Senator Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is for Senator Franzen. Senator Franzen, last year this body put into statute that Minnesota would be the first state in the nation that goes 100% renewable. And that would be for many things, including fuels or transportation. How does your bill move us in that direction?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I would ask assistance of counsel because I can't recall the language of the prior bill, so I can't speak to the specificity of the legislation we passed. I can say that in the testimony you've heard for over 2 hours here, no one who is supporting this bill is saying that biodiesel is bad. I think you've heard that, you know, we have a B5 mandate and that's going to stay in place. We're just asking for some more time to really know the impacts of a B10 mandate and a B20, which would be the next one that would happen just a year from now. So I don't believe this is going backwards and eliminating the mandate. That was never my intention. Maybe there was drafting errors, but it was never my intention as the author of this bill to eliminate biofuels. Again, I support renewable energies. I would say that, you know, the question we have here today in front of us, senators, is whether we have consumer protections. And I think that you've heard from the testimony that we had that some people, some stakeholders were left out. The auto dealers who and the retailers who sell these vehicles to us as consumers were not part of the discussion, and that was alluded to by the Commerce Department, that they will be educated how the impacts of this legislation that was passed in 2002, well before my time here, how that has an impact to the consumers that they provide items and products for. I think we need to think about what do we as a state want to do in terms of stifling the market of diesel vehicles. I think we're moving in that direction. We don't have less. We have more diesel vehicles in the market. We want to continue that. I myself purchased one for that same reason. I believe in the technology. I just think we need to take a closer look of what's the implication of this legislation. And frankly, I appreciate the historical context, but things change. And right now, we have a different dynamic where there's concerns. There's valid and legitimate concerns. I believe one of our testifiers on the opposition of this bill said, you know, you have valid concerns, but we also characterize that as rhetoric. So I'm confused. I think there are legitimate concerns about the pricing, about the climate, about the supply. And frankly, the most important one that, again, has been missing from this debate, probably from back in 2000, was the consumer responsibility in terms of the maintenance that is now passed on to consumers. We talked a lot about the engine manufacturers, but I, as a consumer, would not want to spend more time that I have to having extra oil changes and having to go get more maintenance because the fuel that my state is providing for me does not work with the vehicle that I purchased that was allowed and legitimately sold in our state. So I think as a consumer, you're going to be hearing about this from your constituents. I assure you, when this people get the information and get those pamphlets, they're going to say, what did we as a state do to make sure that we were protected as consumers and that we made an educated decision? Again, I'm not opposed to biodiesel. By no means is this bill is this making that into law, into place, that we're removing the biodiesel standards. It's a question of we need more time. And I think pushing it out a few years is really prudent of us to do. And, you know, consumers need choices. And, again, as senators, we have to know, we have to answer whether Minnesota should allow for the sale of B10 with no consumer choices for anything less than that. So that's the question presented to you today.
And that'll be the last word's going to be from the author of the bill, because I think we went a little overboard on the – we allowed opponents a little extra time. So, Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just add one comment. I met with Mr. Schoenfeld and Mr. Busselman of Farm Bureau And the day that this bill dropped, I didn't have a copy of it, but I specifically asked if they had any concerns. I'd be happy to talk to them. I know Senator Franzen has said the same thing. This is something that we would like to continue to refine. We think that there is some opportunity here to work together. The amendment we passed to both bills fixed a number of the large concerns that were brought forward today. And we'd be happy to meet with them and continue to have those discussions going forward. So, Mr. Chair, I would move that we move this without recommendation to the Environment Committee on Environment.
As amended, I appreciate you and Senator Franzen that you're going to keep this dialogue going. Those in the audience that know my style, it's always been the, if possible, it's not always possible, but the get that half a loaf of bread or whatever, you know, and compromise. So that's where the chair is at on this. So I appreciate you willing to, Senator Pratt and Senator Franzen, to be work in progress. So on the motion, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye. Aye.
How are you doing, Pratt? I don't know.
Sounded close, Mr. Chair.
Motion prevails.
Division.
Division.
Oh. All those in favor? I mean, the two authors are advocating for this, but I guess we already voted. But all those in favor, raise your hand. Oh, boy. Okay. Motion does not prevail. Lay it over. I think we're going to lay the bill over.
Mr. Chair, how can you lay the bill over when it failed?
Do anything I want either. No. I think that's appropriate, isn't it?
The bill's still in the committee. It failed, so somebody have to move to reconsider it at some point.
Mr. Chair, but I think a motion that failed was without recommendation, so we didn't have another motion with recommendation.
Well, we're not getting out of this jam then.
What do we do now?
Okay, move, we adjourn.
Adjourn.